This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today we revisit two recent interviews. Coming up, Zynta A-Stars talks with Western Michigan University professor Brian C. Wilson, who has written a new book on the life of John Harvey Kellogg. But first, a new initiative was launched earlier this year to address the large racial gap in infant mortality in Kalamazoo. WMUK's Erlene McMichael spoke with the CEO of the YWCA of Kalamazoo, Grace Lumbwama, and Deborah Davenport, the Director of Community Health Services in the Los Angeles County Department of Health.
Davenport and Lumbwama worked together on an initiative in Los Angeles that was successful in significantly dropping the Black infant mortality rate there. Let's talk about the term Black infant mortality. What does that actually mean?
When we talk about the infant mortality rate, what we are talking about is the number of births of children that are dying before their first birthday. And this is out of 1,000 births. That's what we are talking about. And then when we talk about the infant mortality rate between the white babies and the black babies, you know, then we are talking about the difference in the two races. And if all the children are receiving the same services and in the same community, same resources, there should not be a gap between babies, whatever color, the rate should be the same.
What is the scope of the problem here in Kalamazoo County in terms of numbers? In a nutshell, what is the issue here?
And I'm new to Kalamazoo. I've only been here 9 months. And just looking at the indicators of health, when you come into a community, you look at what is the well-being of the community. And there are things that you look at that show you the well-being of the community. Infant mortality rate is one of the indicators of the well-being of the community. So when I looked at that and saw the disparities between the white babies and the black babies, it's such a huge gap. You know, for 2000 and maybe 13 data, the infant mortality amongst white babies in Kalamazoo was around 3.9. And within the African-American babies, it went as high as 21 point some. So there is a huge gap for babies who are receiving the same services. So that's the magnitude we have here in Kalamazoo. Just to put it in simple terms, what that number means is that the rate at which black babies are dying is five times than the rate at which white babies are dying.
What does the research tend to say as to what are the factors that lead to a high rate of black infant mortality?
Well, most of the research points to the fact that you can't look at factors like age or income or education for African-American infant mortality because it tends to reach across all of those areas. And it really gets down to issues of preconception health. So what is the health status of the mother going into the pregnancy? And what are the psychosocial factors around that woman that really help determine the outcomes of that birth?
Now, that's probably a good jumping off point to talk about what was going on in Los Angeles. What was fascinating to me is you actually interviewed some of the women who had lost their children. Tell me the process that you all used in Los Angeles.
Well, we have a division in our department called the Maternal Child and Adolescent Health Unit, and it's among the other services that they manage is a huge data unit that goes in and does an analysis of birth outcomes, and they do several different studies. The primary one is called the Fetal Infant Mortality Review, which really goes back and looks at the data around the pregnancy and the delivery and outcomes afterwards. Around these infant deaths in the first year of life. Then the other thing that was done was the LA Mom and Baby Survey, which really actually interviews the moms about what happened during that period so they can get a better idea of maybe some of the psychosocial factors that were impacting things as well. So what we decided to do, since the rates were so high in the Antelope Valley, and this is back in the early 2000s, the rate went up to 32.7 at one point per 1,000 live births. Pretty alarming, and I can see why Kalamazoo is concerned as well. We actually did face-to-face interviews with those mothers, and we really found there was a huge component, not only physical, but also psychosocial, to their ability to manage their health both before, during, and after the pregnancy.
What were some of the contributing factors? For example, my understanding is that they were not able to get access to prenatal care and that transportation was an issue, that there was a great distance in order to get that care.
Yeah, the Antelope Valley is actually a high desert community up in the up northern region of Los Angeles County, which is 4,400 square miles. So it's a pretty big area. And the Antelope Valley is fairly remote behind another big mountain range here in L.A. So getting to services is not easy if you want to come into the L.A. Basin. There are medical services up in the valley and a hospital for delivery. There's now two there. The issue, though, was the ability to access high-risk prenatal care and really how well they were able to access their ongoing medical care, because a lot of these women had pre-existing medical conditions. Some of them had other issues going on in their life as well, no social support. The issue of transportation is a big one up there because it's such a broad, open area, and getting around between the two towns of Lancaster and Palmdale was difficult given the bus system at the time. I'm happy to say since then, things have changed markedly up there.
I should probably take a moment to say that, Ms. Lumbwama, that you were the executive director of the Antelope Valley Partners for Health in Antelope Valley in California, which actually helped spearhead the effort that was done in California. Can you tell me the name of that initiative and what exactly all did it involve?
The initiative was called the Antelope Valley Best Babies Collaborative. And coming into that community, I was probably new in that community as well as I am in Kalamazoo. And working with Debbie, who was the public health officer then in that community, really providing that consistency and leadership of convening the community, really having that grassroots effort to address an issue that was happening in the community. And I think that leadership within the Antelope Valley Partners for Health as an executive director gave me the opportunity to leverage and start that conversation in the community. And we formed a collaborative, which is still existing, that is really looking to improve birth outcomes in that community.
So essentially, you brought lots of people to mm-hmm. the table. Mm-hmm. You gathered the data. You interviewed women to find out who had lost their children, to find out what were some of the factors that contributed to that. And that shaped what it is that you all ultimately did. I think the faith-based community was mm-hmm. involved mm-hmm. as well.
I'll point out a couple of things that were key to making this effort successful and making the collaborative successful in the Antelope Valley. One of the things was really coordinating the different services we had. You know, we had all the different programs, the nurse family practitioner program, the home visiting program. We had the Black Infant Health program. There were a couple of organizations that were doing work in that community, but each one of us was doing work fragmentedly. So the Antelope Valley Partners for Health came together and gave an opportunity for all different players in the community to come together and address the issue. So really coordinating those services was key. But not only, when we talk about infant mortality, it's a very complex issue. So we wanted to make sure that the community voice was involved. You know, churches were involved. The faith-based component was really, really key, engaging those churches into being part of that collaborative and creating a community that welcomed every birth that we had in the Antelope Valley.
My understanding also, Ms. Lumbwama, is that the Y will be, at least in the Kalamazoo community, serving as kind of the nucleus for this collaboration because of your experience in that background.
Mm-hmm, and that is correct. The YWCA will kind of be the lead convener for this conversation. We will provide the consistency. We'll provide the accountability. And also part of that, you know, when you look at the data, we see women who have been abused. 80% of the women that come to us are pregnant. And because this is an issue that really affects women, the YWCA, which is one of the lead agencies here in Kalamazoo that is really looking at empowering women and looking at women's issues, we are going to be at the forefront of leading this initiative and being that backbone agency.
Are you anticipating that this will require funding?
You know, Kalamazoo is such a rich community. We have so many resources. You know, actually, the resources that we have here in Kalamazoo, we didn't have in Los Angeles. So the first thing we're going to do is let us coordinate what we already have. So I think once we do that analysis of what is our current landscape and really analyze our current landscape, then we can talk about funding. But I think we do have the resources here.
Two main areas that can affect Black infant mortality. There's a little chart that you've kind of supplied here. One of them is poverty and what comes out of that, and the other one is racism and discrimination. Ms. Davenport, feel free to jump in on that.
Well, I think it really gets down to, very personally, when we interviewed women about their level of self-esteem. And so some of the programs that we work with, like the state's Black Infant Health Program, were really about not just doing case management around their access to medical care, any medical problems they or their children had, or any other resources that they need, but also doing some empowerment of these women to really take charge of their health and their, you know, their futures and the futures of their children and become actively involved in it. And the program, the Black Infant Health Program, actually has a strong component in it of doing social empowerment for women in the African-American community. So I think it was something they could really identify with, and that program served as the basis for a lot of what we did. And I think it's very important in these instances where, you know, there are these racial disparities.
I'm thinking, for example, when you think about racism, perhaps, again, looking at this chart that I was given, it talks about that that can add more stress in the life of the mother, and so therefore could affect the pregnancy.
Absolutely.
Data has come out and research has come out now that women who are Black, because of the stress within the systematic kind of systems that we have, they're at high risk of infant mortality. So there are more deeper things that we need to have conversation around the systems and how racism plays a role in part of this also.
Ms. Davenport, is there anything you want to add to that?
There's two primary areas when you approach this problem. One is around maternal health, including prematurity. So it really gets into the care of the woman, not only when she's pregnant, but also before she becomes pregnant. Because if there's pre-existing health problems, that's going to really increase stress on the woman when she becomes pregnant. And then for the babies, it really gets down to issues if the woman is having a hard time coping and making ends meet and can't get things together, you know, you can develop more safety issues, health issues. She may not be able to breastfeed, which we know is really important in the early life of infants, and that there may be family and parenting issues that come out of this as well. So it's that whole cycle of someone's family life, not only when they're pregnant, but also before they become pregnant, that really impacts these stressors in their life and ultimately the stressors on their children. So it's very important to address the whole environment of the family as a whole.
Is there anything that either of you would like to offer to the conversation that I've not asked?
Well, I'd just like to say that, you know, the community groundswell for what we did in the Antelope Valley, I think, was really part of the success. Even my public health nurses wanted to pitch in into programs we aren't really part of on a normal routine basis and help do home evaluations on moms to enable community health workers that might be new to doing this to help them succeed at what they were doing. This was a real community effort, even to the point of people in the churches saying, you know, that they were going to just start a process of greeting pregnant women and ask them how they're feeling. Are they in prenatal care? Those kind of basic messages that they can do in a friendly manner that lets women know that they're important and their community cares about them. We even did community baby showers.
And I think what a great opportunity for Kalamazoo to celebrate the birth of every child in this community. You know, I've been talking about going back to the instance of having a village so that we celebrate every child. You know, we are so fortunate that we have the Kalamazoo Promise. You know, as we want these children to excel and graduate and go out to college, let us celebrate their first birthday.
Well, Ms. Davenport and Ms. Limbuama, thank you so much for your time and great success on the effort.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good luck.
For West Southwest, I'm Earlene McMichael.
WMUK's Earlene McMichael spoke with YWCA of Kalamazoo CEO Grace Limbuama and Deborah Davenport, the Director of Community Health Services in the Los Angeles County Department of Health, shortly before the kickoff of the Infant Mortality Community Action Initiative in November. The next action meeting is scheduled for Thursday, March 12th. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. A Western Michigan University professor has written a new book on the life of John Harvey Kellogg. Zinta Astars spoke with Brian C. Wilson for this interview that originally aired on West Southwest December 8th.
Brian C. Wilson is professor in the Department of Comparative Religion at Western Michigan University. Previous publications include Yankees in Michigan and What is Religion? But today we are talking about his newest book, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg and the Religion of Biologic Living. Welcome, Brian. Let's begin with what drew you to writing this book. Originally, you were going to write simply about Battle Creek history?
That's correct. Yeah, I became fascinated with the religious history of Battle Creek. I came to Western in 1996 to take a job in the comparative religion department and decided that I would do a local research project. Part of it was just convenience, and part of it was coming from California, I had all sorts of kind of misconceptions about the cultural history of the Midwest, which I'm happy to say turned out to be completely wrong. And this was one way of kind of getting into the local community.
Okay.
But Battle Creek turned out to be fascinating because it was, in the 19th century, a small community for a variety of reasons that attracted all sorts of interesting new religious groups for the time. So there were Quakers, and they were Hicksite Quakers, so they're very liberal Quakers. Mm-hmm. There were Universalists, people who didn't believe in the reality of hell. There were Swedenborgians who followed the mystical teachings of the Swedish seer Emanuel Swedenborg. There are also freethinkers and deists, and all these people basically got along in Battle Creek. And at a certain point, a number of the Quakers became very interested in spiritualism, the idea that you can contact the spirits of the dead through the ritual of the seance. Mm. And this became, of course, a national craze after 1848. But it especially became fascinating for the Quakers, especially the Hicksite Quakers, the liberal Quakers. Mm-hmm. And so they basically converted en masse into spiritualists and created the first independent church, which was a spiritualist church, which thrived for years in Battle Creek. So Battle Creek, beginning in the late 40s, early 50s of the 19th century, had become a kind of mecca for kind of unconventional religiosity. So that was one of the things that really drew me to Battle Creek.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing about Battle Creek is you can't ignore the fact that it becomes the headquarters for the Seventh-day Adventist Church.
And yeah, I hadn't realized that part, that, you know, we all probably think of Battle Creek as a serial city, and that is a part of this story. But your story about the other brother actually has a lot to do with, as you're saying, religion, the Seventh-day Adventists. So tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, the Seventh-day Adventists descend from a movement called Millerism, which popped up in the Northeast in the 1820s and 1830s. And William Miller believed he'd kind of cracked the biblical code and could predict roughly the date of the end of the world, when the second coming would occur. And he convinced a lot of people with his logic that this was true. And so a lot of people kind of broke away from their existing churches and began to follow William Miller. Well, when the predicted date didn't occur, another date was set, and tensions were kind of ratcheted up after that. And finally, they decided it was going to be October 22nd, 1844. That was going to be the date. Mm. Well, that rolled around too, and of course, nothing happened. And the vast majority of Miller's followers essentially fell away. They lost confidence in him. And William Miller himself went back to his farm and retired, and that's pretty much the last we heard of him. But there are a number of people who believed something had happened on that date. Hmm. It just didn't happen on earth, it happened in heaven. And so they developed this notion that Jesus in heaven, in the heavenly temple, had begun a process of cleansing the heavenly temple, and when he was finished with this process, then he would return for the second coming on earth. So he was coming, it's going to be soon, and October 22nd, 1844 marked an important date. Mm-hmm. You know, the beginning of this process, but it's only the beginning, not the end. So people who were willing to accept this idea came to call themselves Adventists. Advent just simply meaning arrival. Mm-hmm. And among those Adventists, there were some who decided that they were going to adopt the Saturday Sabbath. So instead of celebrating the Sabbath on Sunday, they would go back to the old Jewish Sabbath of Saturday. And that's why they're called the Seventh-day Adventist.
And I remember in reading the book that there was even something in there about how his parents, the child when he was small, didn't have him learn how to read because they thought, well, what's the point?
In the early days, there was a high degree of expectation that the Second Coming was going to occur soon.
Yeah.
And so this always creates tensions because how far do you have to go to, you know, maintain your normal life if everything's going to get disrupted very quickly? And this is one of the stories that's told about Kellogg, that Kellogg's father thought, why bother sending my kid to school if the Second Coming is around the corner? Well, the movement, the Seventh-day Adventist movement, began evolving, and they did start to begin to create institutional structures for the long haul and basically pushing back their expectations of the end a little bit farther away than they normally thought. And so education became a part of that. And luckily for John Harvey Kellogg, he did have some rudimentary elementary education, learned to read and write. And he himself was an autodidact. He just loved reading and learning.
So the history of Battle Creek doesn't begin with cereal. It begins with this sanitarium that Kellogg built and with this concept of biologic living. Explain to us what biologic living is.
Well, biologic living is the idea that just as God had created a series of moral laws to help us live in this life and to help us achieve salvation, the Ten Commandments, obviously, he also created a series of physical laws of the universe, laws that basically impact our bodies, and that we are obliged to follow the physical laws of health just like we're following the moral laws of the Ten Commandments. So in a lot of cases, Kellogg would refer to the greater Ten Commandments, and that included biologic living. And biologic living was this idea that you not only could live a moral life, but you also had to live physically a life that would essentially lead to what he called physiological righteousness.
Mm.
And in time, he came to believe that purity of body was just as important as purity of soul for one's ultimate salvation. And that's the key to biological living.
So he saw the possibility of a perfect human being. Is that right? What was perfection to him? Well, I guess both on the religion side and the physical side. What did he see as the perfect human being?
Well, he did believe that God essentially had given human beings the resources to achieve perfection in this life, both spiritually and physically. Now, there had been a long strain of spiritual perfectionism in this country, and it starts with Charles Grandison Finney back in the early 19th century. So this wasn't a new idea, but Kellogg's idea that married to this concept, you could also have a perfect body, this was something new. And in fact, it was troubling to the leadership within the Seventh-day Adventist Church, because the leader of the church, the prophetess Ellen G. White, always made it very clear that one should strive for bodily health, but perfection would never be achieved in this life.
Mm.
And it would not, that in itself would not impact one's salvation.
So how did he handle, say, disabled people?
Well, that was always a problem for him. There was a certain amount of latitude based on your hereditary antecedents. And so some people, he realized, were going to be born with certain birth defects, and these were not going to be essentially correctable in this life, given any regime. So for them, it's a matter of suffering in this life, but ultimately would not be a stumbling block for salvation in the next. Now, for somebody who starts off with a clean slate and then spends a life smoking and drinking and and being debauched and ruins their body, then they would be judged for this.
His philosophy, his religion clashed often. Is that more his philosophy, or perhaps it was his personality? He seems to be a powerful personality. And in fact, at the end of the story, he is excommunicated from the church?
Yes, they call it disfellowshipping.
Okay.
And in 1907, the church, it was pretty much by mutual agreement, Kellogg and his brother Will K. Kellogg both were struck from the rolls of the Battle Creek Church. And the issues involved are pretty complex. Part of its ego, John Harvey Kellogg has a tremendous ego and a tremendous sense of ambition and a tremendous sense of his own destiny. He's one of these people who really feels he has his own destiny. And he goes up against Ellen G. White, who, for her part, also has a tremendous sense of her own destiny. And in the beginning, they work together. But over time, of course, you have two charismatic persons within the church, and this becomes a point of friction. So there was that. Kellogg really wanted the Seventh-day Adventist Church to really focus completely on what he called medical missionary work. And he wanted the Seventh-day Adventist Church to pretty well downplay the kind of distinctive doctrinal things that made Seventh-day Adventism a sectarian movement and adopt primarily medicine as their way of proselytizing people. Ellen White, on the other hand, thought that this showed a lack of balance. The medical work was important, but the preaching the word of the end was even more important. So you had these kind of theological kinds of tensions between them. And then theologically, Kellogg always was concerned with reconciling his Seventh-day Adventism. He'd been brought up in it, in the heart of Seventh-day Adventism. Mm-hmm. He wanted to reconcile that with the kind of modern directions that science and medicine were going in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. So he was always torn. How much of his Adventism does he keep? How much does the kind of modern world impinge on his new worldview? And he worked very hard to come up with some kind of workable synthesis between the two. Mm. And in part, this entailed Seventh-day Adventist belief in a very concrete anthropomorphic God, a very concrete anthropomorphic Jesus, and they believe in a very concrete anthropomorphic life in heaven after death. For Kellogg, his vision of God was not anthropomorphic, but a personal God, but a God that basically pervaded the entire world. And in fact, God undergirded all the processes in the world, physical, biological, moral. He was always there. His power was always kind of undergirding everything that was going on. So he talked about God being the servant of man.
Simply interesting concept.
His ubiquity everywhere and basically holding up the fabric of the universe. And of course, those kinds of comments about God being the servant of man offended people like Ellen White, who wanted to protect the sovereignty and dignity of God.
So was this the beginnings of what today we call holistic living? Are there similarities there?
Oh, very definitely. And it actually antedates Dr. Kellogg himself, because in the early 19th century, there are a group of thinkers that historians later have called Christian physiologists. Mm-hmm. And these were people like William A. Andrus and Sylvester Graham. Sylvester Graham was a Presbyterian minister who believed that, again, diet was as important for the ultimate salvation of the soul as was sin or any kind of behavior.
Thank you. We've been talking with Brian C. Wilson about Dr. John Harvey Kellogg and the religion of biologic living.
WMUK's Zinda Astars spoke with Western Michigan University Professor of Comparative Religion Brian C. Wilson. The interview originally aired December 8th. Wilson will discuss his book at the Portage District Library on January 15th at 6:30 p.m. Beginning in January, you'll have another opportunity to hear West Southwest on Mondays and Thursdays. The show will still air at 9:30 both mornings, and beginning January 5th, there will be a replay of West Southwest Monday and Thursday afternoons at 3:30. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.